listening to Dig Deep. It's KEXE, KBXE, and our podcast and on our website, KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me in the studio are our liberal commentator, Aaron Brown, and our conservative, Chuck Marone. I get kind of both comments from people like, you shouldn't call them those labels anymore. And then I get people saying, you should. How come you don't say that every time you introduce them? So I don't know where to go. But the point is, these are guys that come from kind of different political backgrounds. They shouldn't be friends. They shouldn't be talking or civil to each other in this day and age. And here they are discussing the issues of the day. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Glad to be here with my friend Chuck.
We're not friends outside of here.
Yeah,
we rarely hate each other.
Yeah, right. It's all an act.
Well, and that's kind of our topic today, because I've been overhearing people saying it's never been this bad this political season. We're recording this before the election time, but you probably will hear it afterwards. But is that true? Has it ever been this bad?
No, this is the end times, basically. It's funny because there is this, you can go to any time in all of human history and get apocalyptic speak. There's always someone who's going to stand on a soapbox somewhere and say, the end is near, repent, like now is the worst time ever. So I do think it's probably healthy to keep in mind that no, things have been worse. There's two that jump out to me just right away as I think about this. The first one, you know, leading up to the Civil War, we had people in like U.S. Congress that were beating each other.
Yeah, with a stick.
With sticks, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Literally causing physical damage to each other over issues that were being debated. I also think back to, I'm a huge history buff of the American Revolution. And it's funny today because we look at Facebook and Twitter and Fox News and MSNBC, and we say like, oh my gosh, this is such partisan, crazy stuff. The yellow journalism of the Revolutionary War era, and really that whole kind of period of time.
Well, most of the 1800s, that was the standard kind of papers. That's where a lot of newspapers have the name Republican or Democrat or Whig in their title, because they were there to, you know, parrot the talking points for that specific party.
They were essentially like propaganda machines. And so you didn't have journalistic standards. Mm-hmm. You weren't reporting fact. You were reporting rumor, innuendo, gossip, whatever you could.
And there was good journalism, but it was much more from a point of view.
Right.
You know, you got some good journalists. I've read a few that in my research that I've done over the years. But the issue is they're clearly coming at it from a bias.
And it's almost,
which is what we see now, and that seems out of place, I think, because we had kind of a golden era there where, you know, the journalism community was trying to be more balanced or have this ideal kind of behavior, and now we're watching as people, popular support and money follows the more biased journalism that people seem to want to lap up.
Right. That golden age is the interesting thing, because I think we did have, when radio and television came on the scene, because there were fewer players, and because those players, in a sense, had not only to meet a global culture, you know, a global sense of propriety in what they were doing. You couldn't be, we're going to target 10% of the country, the other 90%, who cares? You had to actually appeal to this kind of broad sense of humanity. You did have to approach it very differently. Now we have many, many more players. Each finds an advantage to having their own little niche. And I think it was that brief period of time when that new technology came into place that got rid of the free-for-all, the printing press, in a sense, which is what the yellow journalism era was. But we weren't quite yet to the internet era where we were back to that free-for-all.
And I think part of that era with radio and television, I think that's a really good observation, because when those technologies came online, people were afraid of them.
Right.
People were afraid that our brains would be rotted out of our head by this filth and programming that would be coming across these wires. And so the regulatory environment was very prescribed for equal time and a lot of things that we kind of assume that broadcast networks will be fair to everybody because of regulatory environment. It created this sense that they were then training journalists for that environment and that there were rules that you had to follow. When the internet came along, people were afraid of it, sure, or had their doubts about it, but nobody I don't think, it's kind of funny, it snuck up on us in a way that people didn't think of it as the thing that would turn elections within a less than 10 years.
Right.
Because I think you can safely say our current and last president were internet-driven presidencies. In other words, the people who supported those candidates got a bulk of their information from the internet. That may not change until, you know, there's a sunstorm and the internet goes down.
Right. or some other like radical technology.
Yeah, or some other, you know, brain-based technology, right. Telepathy or something, whatever's next. But basically, the era changed and there was no strong regulatory environment surrounding it, and also no real cultural consideration of that fact. I think a lot of people would push back on the notion that the internet influences their vote at all, when I think in reality, we are wholly influenced by, a lot of us are wholly influenced by what we're surrounding ourselves with and what we're exposed to in our internet behaviors. So it's kind of crazy that way.
Right.
So you cited the last two presidencies. When did things start to change? Is it the internet? Is that when things
started
to change?
Well, it wasn't just the internet, but I think the usage of the internet changed. And when people started gathering their information primarily from the internet rather than from newspapers and even television news, things changed. And I think the major political parties were both in their own way slow to pick up on how this was working. I think Obama caught Republicans by surprise when he came out of nowhere. And certainly Trump caught Democrats and everybody by surprise the way he emerged. And really, social media, people sharing stuff with each other using a platform that is not the government, not the public square, but rather a private company, whether that's Twitter or Facebook or any of the others. And people sharing stuff on this format is the chief way that people make up their minds about how to vote. I don't know that, you know, even Mark Zuckerberg or the people behind these companies would even have necessarily predicted that. And I think when we saw in the last election where not just Russia, which is the big headline getter, but all kinds of private and public entities from who knows where, we don't even know the names of most of them, are able to flood the zone with advertising, with subtly crafted messages that appear to come from news sources and memes and the imagery we see that are backed up with short, snappy statements. This is coming from who knows where. And a lot of it is increasingly uncivil, psychologically driven. It's designed with, really, it frankly resembles propaganda we've seen from different regimes over the many years. It's resembling that more and more. It's come upon us not because we all signed up for it, but because it's just emerging in a marketplace of ideas as the dominant way that we communicate about politics. And I think that's having effects on people.
I agree with Aaron, and I do think that some fundamental things have changed. I think it's important, though, to step back and realize that this is not emerging out of nowhere.
Right. Disagreement is part of human nature.
Right?
Yeah, it's required for a democratic system.
I graduated from college in 95, and so the web was just starting to... I remember my first job as an engineer, you were not allowed to have the internet on your computer at work. They felt it would be an unnecessary distraction, and I was able to kind of, because I knew what I was doing, hotwire it into my own computer so I could do research and other things. You look at that, so this was, you know, the early council meetings I was going to as a young engineer. The verbal violence that would happen at those places over the shrubs in your yard and how they were going to be dug up, or the city's policy regarding the restoration of boulevards, or, you know, how the city was going to be assessing this thing out, the just sheer intensity and hatred and anger that would come out amongst people who sat in the same pew at church and, you know, had kids in the same class at school, and they would show up at these meetings and they would hate each other and just be vicious and mean and call up something that, you know, your family did 30 years ago to my family. This is part of like humanity. I think that we do ourselves a disservice in a sense when we kind of disembody ourselves and say our discourse is all a result of the internet. It's all a result of, and that's not what Aaron said, but I think there's that conversation in society that like, oh, things have never been this bad. Things have been this bad in the past. There's many, many examples of things
being
this bad.
They've just manifested differently.
They've manifested at different levels and different places. I think the soup that we are in, I think the body of water that we swim in is very different today than it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. But I think the humans within it are very much the same. Yeah. And so we're dealing with the same flaws, the same, you know, emotions that we have, and they manifest in crazy ways.
I remember reading about, and of course a proper person would cite this correctly, but I remember reading about a French writer who came to America in the very early days of the Republic, shortly after the Constitution was ratified. And this might have been around the time of Andrew Jackson, I want to say, which was a very contentious time in our history. Andrew Jackson was the outsider who kind of thumbed his nose at the aristocracy to an extent, with limited, you know, a limited basis of that. But during this time, during the campaign between John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, which was a real humdinger, kind of like the ones we see today, there were words being exchanged that would suggest, this French writer was saying, you know, they're talking about ending, that the country will end if their candidate is unsuccessful, and they're talking about all this. And then the election happened, and it was a contentious one. John Quincy Adams won, you know, without the benefit of the popular vote, or it was one of those elections kind of like we've just seen. And the French writer spoke with a supporter of Andrew Jackson, who had been very vocal about, this country is going to be over if this Jackson isn't elected. And he kind of laughed and kind of slapped the guy on the back and said, you know, you say things in the heat of a campaign and we'll be all right. And basically, you know, obviously there's a lot of things wrong with the eras that would follow, and lots of hardship and heartache in this country. But the rhetoric is not the end of the story. And that's, I think, America is a place of over-the-top rhetoric, over-the-top everything, you know. But in the end, it has, at least historically, reverted to a norm of sorts. And that norm does change with time. You know, obviously the things that were, when only white men could vote at the time, that's changed for the better. And it can, there's still work to do. And it, ideally, it continues to get better. But this kind of rhetoric, that's the end of the world if we lose, has been around before.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates are often looked at as this like pinnacle of American discourse. Here's two fine people standing on soapboxes, eloquently discussing back and forth. Mm-hmm. If you actually go read them, they were not. Yeah, you know, in the.
I don't think a modern television audience could sit through one.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
But if you look at them, it's not like they were, oh, yes, you make a fine point.
Oh, no, they don't do
any
of that.
Oh, Mr. Douglas, you're a wonderful man. Like, yeah. No, they were vicious to each other. They were going back and forth. They were zingers and gotchas and all that stuff. The same thing that we do today, they were doing in the context of their culture. I am positive at the time that there were people, I know this for a fact, at the time there were people who were saying that Lincoln, he's a radical. If you're seduced by his magic words, we're going to wind up in a civil war. And oh, that Douglas, he's just a terrible person. If you listen to him, we're going to have slavery forever. And these were high, high stakes. This was like a blood sport. Like people said, this is not some like eloquent statesman debating back and forth. These are two like ruffians going at it. The future of our nation and our civilization's at stake.
I think that exposes, though, one of the tricky things about all this, because America is the two stories, or actually many stories, but really it's the best of times, the worst of times, all takes place here in America.
Right.
And I think that example of, because, you know, during the Jackson Adams time, slavery was still an issue. Obviously, Adams, being from Massachusetts, was more of the abolitionist, and Jackson was more of the Southern, you know, the Southern Party, Democratic Party at the time. But when you talk about the lead up, the Lincoln-Douglas lead up, and the fact that those debates were contentious and certainly the marquee event of their time, underneath this is a real issue that really was a poison in our Constitution that took 100 years to fix, and that the aftermath has, I think you could arguably say, it hasn't totally been figured out yet, even today, another 150, 60 years later. When there's a huge issue that's affecting people, our over-the-top rhetoric and return to norm, over-the-top rhetoric and return to norm, sometimes I don't think serves us very well. Mm-hmm. I don't think that serves us very well. It becomes hard for people to see what is really an issue, defining issue of our times that will determine the path of the country, and what's really just partisan rancor. And I think that's what's hard about the times today, is the level of rhetoric is calling the other side a big bunch of jerks. or other worse names that I can't say on the radio. Is that the end of the world? No, it's been done before many times. But on the other hand, it becomes hard to tell what is the most defining election of our time and what is maybe just a regular election,
right?
You know, in the context of our country. I think that's what makes it so hard, is people can't tell which is which anymore.
Well, I think that is the sea we're swimming in, right, is one. And I want to talk about this in the next segment, like, because I do think things are fundamentally different today than they have been in the past. And I'll give you, I think, what the prime example of that is. You could go back and read Cicero in the period of the Roman triumvirate, where they're having literally on the verge of the Roman civil war that would end the Republic and bring in emperors for hundreds of years. So this was like a huge tumultuous thing. You have this rhetoric where they're calling each other like the nastiest, worst names. Here's the thing. If you didn't want to be part of it, you could avoid it. Outside of the rhetoric, like, you could go about your business. You, as like a Roman citizen,
like a farmer.
Yeah. If you were a farmer, you were like vaguely aware of what was going on in Rome, but you weren't getting like Cicero's writings pumped into your brain like all the
time. Cicero wasn't like, hey, Cicero here, I need $25 exactly, by tonight. Yeah,
exactly. And it wasn't like, hey, it's Cicero. You know that dude, Julius Caesar? He's coming to take your farm and take your wife and like ruin you. Just send me $25 and we could forestall this whole thing. You were able to be a passive observer of history. And I think the big thing that's happened now, and I think the thing that's raised the tension level, is that we're no longer able to be. You are going to be immersed in it if you have any level of engagement with society at all. It's so very hard to avoid.
A really good example, maybe as a segue into our next segment, is a teacher that I know talked about. She was showing a YouTube video in her class in front of elementary students, and she's about to queue up this tape. Often they have ads on before them. It was a negative ad from the current election, from the current election cycle. So she has to sit through this 30-second ad to show this educational video. But because that's the way the metrics showed up, you know, that's what happened. And so these kids, maybe they don't care. They probably don't. But but it's
Joe Radinovich.
That's the one it was, you know, too.
And it's like, this is where I think things have changed, and maybe we are in the end of times. I think it's certainly different.
Oh boy.
But
I was hoping we wouldn't go
in
there,
Chuck. Yeah. In our next segment, we will look at the end of times. We'll talk more about the current political and climate or discourse and civility.
In a way, I think the end of times would make things better. Like, we'd all get along, I think, at the end of times.
I think, so like, what does it matter at that point?
This is Dig Deep. That's Chuck Marone and Aaron Brown. You know,
I've been working on all of my days, and I've been trying to find what's been in my mind as the days keep turning into night.